Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
To The Time Is Now, a podcast all about the TV series Millennium. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host today, Tony Black, and I'm back once again for one of my regular sort of partners on The Time Is Now quite frequently. I think we've done all of my appearances pretty much on season two together, and we had to come back for this one. I'm once again joined to talk about The Mikado by Darren Mooney. Darren, it's great to talk to you again on this pretty, you know, futuristic technological episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that I think that we're completing our kind of like our holiday themed trilogy, a little triptych. You know, we started out with The Curse of Frank Black, which is about Halloween. Then we moved on to Midnight of the Century for Christmas. And finally, we arrive at The Mikado, which is all about the transition of the Zodiac New Year, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, well, there you go. I couldn't have put that better, could I? You know, perfect capstone. I did do the Hand of Saint Sebastian as well. I mustn't forget that, because that's just a lot of fun. And me and Kurt had a bit of a laugh with that silliness. But yeah, I had to come back for this one, which is a particular favourite of mine, I have to say. So The Mikado is the 13th episode of season 2 of Millennium. It was written by Michael R. Perry in his first script for Millennium, and directed by Roderick J. Priddy. And it sees a group of young boys witness what looks to be a murder on a live webcam feed, which leads Frank Black into an investigation alongside Peter Watts and Brian Rodecker into a killer called Avatar, who seems to have returned. A notorious serial killer who seems to have returned via the medium of webcams and web chats and the internet, which we should be so-called in capitals, given it's 1998. And this is a beautiful episode in terms of representing the early internet on television. So, Darren, why don't we start off, as we usually do, by giving us a rating out of 10 for The Mikado and telling us what you think of the episode in general.
This is a 9 out of 10 for me, and arguably it's only a 9 out of 10 for me because I feel the need to be stingy to keep my critical credibility when it comes to rating second season episodes. This would very easily be a 10, I imagine, if it was in the first season or maybe even the third season as well. And it is. It's a powerhouse episode of television. It holds up remarkably well, considering what it's doing. It has, again, as you mentioned, it's a late 90s episode about technology. So there's something, and again, it's amazing how fast technology moves, so that even though, like, you and I are aware of the internet, there's a sense of technology having moved so fast that even though I remember the little touches in this episode, and we'll talk about them as we go through, because there are some wonderful little touches, it almost seems like a snapshot of history. It's like, remember when the internet worked like that, you know? Remember when, like, you had to go into, when we called it cyberspace, the information superhighway, yeah. Tony.
Remember
when it worked the way that it does here, where you have, like, the slow loading screens, when you pick up the phone, you get the screech of the dial-up broadband, or dial-up, not broadband, dial-up sort of LAN, basically, yeah. And kind of screeching in your ear, deafening you. And it's full of all these little touches that make it kind of a wonderful time capsule sort of episode, which feels entirely appropriate. This is a show called Millennium, about the transition, you know, from the 90s into, spoiler, the new millennium. But one of the things that I really, really, really like about it, and something I was very pleasantly surprised coming back to it today for my first time rewatching it since I reviewed it, what, about 4 or 5 years ago now, is that it actually holds up remarkably well in terms of structure, storytelling, and kind of, you know, thematic dynamics as well. What it's doing is very clever, even if the way that it's doing it maybe looks a little quaint and weird and slightly surreal from a perspective where everybody has a fire hose of information coming into their house these days. I really, really love this. I think it's a fantastic episode of television. I think, and what's interesting is in the second season, it's also an episode that I think works brilliantly thematically with the rest of the second season. We'll talk a little bit about context and about where it came from and about how Perry sort of imagined it originally and kind of the culture shock of where it ended up. And like Perry's argument about whether or not this is really a first season episode that kind of snuck into the second season. But I think that what I really love about it is that it works both as a standalone kind of self-contained episode. You could show somebody who has never seen Millennium this and they get it. But it also works as an episode of the second season because it taps into some of those core themes that are running through it as well. It's got some of the recurring fascinations of the season around it. And so it manages to have kind of the best of both worlds, which isn't something that's always possible in the context of a kind of a season as tightly serialized and kind of highly constructed as the second season of Millennium actually is.
Yeah, I couldn't put that better myself, really. I think, I mean, I'll go for it. This is a full-on 10 for me, 10 out of 10. This might be my favourite episode of Millennium, outside of The Curse of Frank Black, obviously, because that is my favourite episode of Millennium. I've gone on record saying that a few times in this season. But outside of that, this is...
Continuity error!
This is a very close second for me. I love every single moment of this entire episode. And I think it does stem from the fact that it feels like... You're absolutely right when you say you could show this to somebody who'd never really seen Millennium and they pick up on it, because it does feel like, well, I mean, it's obviously, and like you say, we'll talk about the touchstones for it, but a big touchstone for this is the Zodiac murders, you know, the real life Zodiac murders, which some 10 years later was brilliantly brought to the screen by David Fincher. And it has that feel of a rich detective thriller mixed with this, for the time, futuristic internet sort of story, which now, as you say, feels a little bit quaint and is quite comical to look back from our perspective, but it's pushing the boundaries of what not just Millennium is doing, but also what you would see on television and the kind of ways that Millennium would tell stories in a really quite innovative fashion. And yeah, okay, we can look back on it now and we can chuckle at the presentation, but it's worth thinking about how it was intentionally tapping into a medium that wasn't necessarily massively well popularized at the time. You know, internet webcams and chat rooms and things like that. They were still, you know, this was back in the days when, like, a dating service was reserved for weirdos and perverts and the outcasts of society, whereas nowadays everybody's on Tinder, you know? So what you saw in the Mikado and what Frank and Peter cannot get their heads around is now the normal, is now norm, you know, in this day and age. So it's fascinating to look back and see how this episode is prophetic in some senses. And it's, and you know, I suppose this is something best to talk about towards the end, but I feel like if there was ever a time to see Avatar again, it would be in our modern day and age in some context, because it feels like what Frank talks about at the very end about that next thing, that next weakness, that we're already there, you know, with the technology we have right now.
Two things that I would note there, Tony. First of all, when you notice the kind of legacy and kind of cinematic kind of history that the Mikado was tied to, I notice that you happen to overshadow the kind of Diane Lane classic Untraceable.
Oh, how could I forget that? You know, I mean,
how could you forget
what's
that?
Wrong with me?
It's only like the 82nd worst movie of all time. but more to the point, actually, and I think that this is kind of interesting, and it kind of speaks to where the episode's positioned, because when we're talking about it, it's important to provide context. The second season of Millennium aired alongside the fifth season of The X-Files. And notably, the fifth season of The X-Files had an episode called Killswitch, which was written by William Gibson, who's known as one of the founding fathers of cyberpunk, obviously, having written Neuromancer and various other works as well. And when he pitched the episode that would become Killswitch, He originally wanted to write an episode about a haunted website, but Carter told him, no, you're not doing that. Not enough people know what a website is. Which kind of gives you a sense of, like, how far ahead of the curve Mikado was in the context of television in 1998. If The X-Files is going, not enough people know what a website is, and then Mikado is going, ah, but we're also going to do least significant digit and webcams and IPS routing and stuff like that on top of it, I kind of love that. So, I mean, yes, it is dated, but at the time it was very much ahead of the curve. And being honest, I think that, like, and I think the episode makes this point, and it's probably something we'll talk about when we talk about the thematic dynamics. I think the episode is smart in arguing that as much as the medium, and you mentioned it there when you talked about, like, the next thing and why this might be the time for Avatar to return, and we'll get to that at the end. But, like, the medium is not the message. It's just a vehicle for the message. And there's a sense of that being true as much of the kind of Zodiac's crimes, you know, which are defined as a kind of a sick performance art. He's performing for us at one point, Frank states. But they're also true of the episode itself, where, like, its core themes and dynamics are arguably as relevant today. And, I mean, we'll probably talk about that when we get to talking about what the episode's about, as they were when they were initially broadcast. And I think there's something very powerful in that juxtaposition, because it kind of gives you something that is, and again, this is when people ask me, like, what makes, say, a great performance? I think that what makes a great performance is what makes genius, which is the ability to hold two conflicting and seemingly contradictory ideas in your head at the same time. So great performance is something that's kind of, like, you know, both vulnerable and also very strong at the same time. And when I think about what makes a brilliant story or kind of a great story is this idea of being two seemingly contradictory things at the same time. So the Mikado manages to be both incredibly 1998 and also strangely timeless as well, and that's a beautiful balancing act for a piece of television.
Yeah, 100%, and I think you're absolutely right in that it doesn't feel the, you know, the style of it may be slightly dated, but what it's saying is absolutely still relevant today, and it's incredible how far ahead it was looking in a way, even maybe if Michael Perry didn't quite realise just how prophetic this would be. So, you know, it's a fascinating episode. There's lots to discuss. But before we do, let's have a guess at the IMDb rating, which is something we like to do on the...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Xcast, and we do here. So, where would you place this on the usual sort of, you know, roughly around the 9, let's say 9.5 down to about very, very, very late, like 6s, early 7s. Where would you say this is going to be?
Okay, my gut is saying high, which means I'm immediately like, no. Part of me is like, so yeah, the voting on Millennium is a lot more kind of focused than on The X-Files, so you're typically going to see about, say, 280, 290 people voting on an episode. You're going to see that, and I wonder whether those tastes skew kind of conservative, so the people who are voting are the people who watch the second season as a whole and maybe see this as an outlier, or are they the people who watch the entire series of Millennium and see this as, like, a quintessential serial killer episode? So I'm going to go with, let's say, 8.7.
Oh, Darren, I feel like you were about to say 8.6 and you would have been bullseye if you'd said that. So very, very good guess. Very good. Out of 260 votes, so you're absolutely right.
Wow, I was actually quite close.
You were really close there as well, yeah. 8.6, but it does actually put it in the very, very top tier of the season. So, you know, we go from the highest rated episode is actually Somehow Satan Got Behind Me, and then beyond after that, you've basically got the Mikado, Ose Chung's Doomsday Defense, And
wait, the Mikado beat Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense.
They're equally tied alongside at the time he's now, the final episode. They're all at 8.6, yeah. And only somehow Satan all got right. behind me, just edges past it. So it's sort of joint second, in a way, for the season.
I kind of love, by the way, that like the title somehow Satan got behind me means that every time you credit it as being the best episode of the season, it sounds like you're being incredibly cynical. And at number one, it's somehow Satan got behind me.
I hadn't thought of that. That's true. I'm never going to look at that episode title again in the same way now. So yeah, it's a high-rated episode. Justifiably, you know, we often find doing these IMDb ratings, as we've done for some years now, that sometimes we'll see something and we'll go, what? How is it that low or that high? But this, I think, is, you know, I'd have it in the nines. But, you know, I think it's right that it's high up in the second season of Millennium. So, yeah, I'm very pleased about that. So let's dig in then. There's a lot to discuss. Let's fire up the... what was the name of... Well, the fire hose, yeah. What was the name of the... the modem. Like, what was it? There was a name for it, wasn't there, back in the day? You know, the one that would chug along. What was it you used to actually...
Oh, that would make the little sort of like, yeah, little train engine dial-up. In your computer.
Dial-up, sort of dial-up. There was probably dial-up. Another name for it, but yeah, it was like a dial-up sort of... Yeah. That'll do.
Sorry, that was an actual effect, by the way. Thank you for slotting that in, Tony.
That is a perfect transition to the next part of this podcast. So the Mikado begins with, you know, the time-honoured classic idea of three young lads going online, pretending they're doing their homework, but no, they're actually looking for porn. And this is back in the day. This made me laugh in that they were so excited at something. What was it? Something like 400 porn links. Guys, there's about 39 hours of porn on the internet. And I was like, oh.
What a wonderful wonder we have.
What a world we live in. 39 hours of porn on the entire internet. Amazing.
It's like more than a day, Tony.
Yeah, more than a whole day of porn for them to watch. Amazing. And they only have to click through every single link to access it. If only they came up with, you know, a website that would collate every video, you know, every pornographic video on the internet. Easy to access. What a shame they didn't think of that. But
the world just isn't ready, Tony. Some sort of hub, as it were. A hub of porn.
Where you can access that porn. You and porn, you know, can be... Anyway, we should stop this. I mean, we don't know anything about this anyway, Darren, obviously, do we? We're just guessing. So, you know, we don't know anything about any of this stuff. So, in this... A teaser. You have these three guys who are looking for this stuff, and then their third mate comes in with a special web address on like a napkin that he's got from a guy
in a pizza store, which is kind
of... which allows them to type this web address in, and they access the creepy murder room that Avatar has set up with a webcam, and the number 37122 on the back. Which obviously leads to them witnessing basically snuff. You know, you would say this is snuff, wouldn't you, really? It's real life murder, which is presented. They think it's just, you know, a girl going to take off her clothes and she gets her throat slit when the number of web hits hit 37122. What do you think about this? I mean, when I was watching it, I was thinking, yeah, okay, if you take away the unintentional comedy now of the porn and everything and the lads looking for that, I think back to myself, I can't remember how I felt watching this. And whether I really understood quite what this stuff, this technology was. Because, you know, back in 1998, when I would have watched this, when it first went, you know, aired on Sky One or whatever it was, I didn't have the internet. You know, the internet was something I didn't even really discover till the early 2000s for myself. I wasn't one of these people on the chat rooms for The X-Files and, you know, Babylon 5 and all these shows in the 90s. As awesome as that sounds, to be honest, I would have loved to have been involved in that, but I wasn't. So it was probably to a lot of people watching... this was all quite alien, wasn't it? I'd imagine at the time.
Well, I mean, keep in mind, I did come to it quite late, actually, because I watched this when I was in college. Again, I'd watched some of the X-Files live and basically been like, well, what else has he done? And watched Millennium kind of coming off the back of that. So I had already been taught by Avenue Q that the internet is for porn. So I was not that surprised by it. But like watching it, two things really jump out to me. And I actually really, really like the intro for two reasons. First of all, is that you immediately get the sense of kind of the paradox of timeliness and timelessness. Because as you point out, it's the timeless tradition of teenagers trying to look at porn. Now, whether that's in magazines that they're buying in brown paper bags or stashes they found God knows where, or maybe even like you can imagine going back and there being like vaguely offensive etchings on cave walls that they looked at when their parents weren't watching or something like that. But it's kind of, it's one of those things that is kind of like a tradition in terms of how we portray teenagers in film and in media and stuff like that. So this is seen as just another iteration of it. And the second thing that I really, really like about the intro, and it's something that runs through the rest of the episode, is that there's a kind of a strange sense of kind of compassion and empathy running through this. Because again, one of my issues with, say, certain procedural TV shows and certain kind of, you know, sort of Law and Order television shows is that they can occasionally seem very judgmental in kind of their portrayal of kind of certain things and certain aspects of human existence. I have complicated opinions about pornography, to be absolutely honest. You know, I think that there are issues around it and issues with addiction and the way in which kind of it's sometimes enfolded into popular culture. But I also think at the same time, people are mature adults and, you know, there's a point at which people have to decide for themselves in terms of stuff like that. So I actually really like that the episode goes to, these are kids looking at porn, but they still have an incredibly strong moral compass. Because the first thing they do when they see that video isn't close the window, pretend it never happened, and go back to like going outside. They actually say, no, we got to tell somebody. They own up, they act, they sort of act like responsible people in that situation, which I really, really like. And it happens throughout the episode as well, where things will come up that will seem unusual or odd. And like, particularly in the context of television in 1998, you know, where like the X-Files was still making jokes about like Langley getting prison raped, for example, and thinking those were hilarious, that you'd have like a refusal in this episode to say victim blame, where, you know, when Frank is picking out which one of them's the victim, he says she's the victim, and Rodecker says why, because she uses a computer, and Frank is very quick to say no, because he does. That's why she's the victim. Not because she did anything dangerous or risky or anything that I'm judging her for. She just happened to be in the target pool that he would pick from. And the episode kind of does that throughout. And even like with Rodecker, who is portrayed as this guy, he's goofy and silly and a little nerdy and kind of like a little awkward. But he's portrayed as a sympathetic character, and he talks about how he participates in some of these online communities, how he changes his identity online and becomes this other person as well. And the episode doesn't see that as weird or creepy or awkward. You know, there's no moment where Ice-T wanders into says, so it's like going outside, but you're wearing a different face, right? Or something like that. You know, where like that great John Mulaney bit where like he explains that every episode of SVU involves people explaining very simple concepts to Ice-T so the older members of the audience can follow along. There's something very surprisingly non-judgmental about the Mikado that I really, really, really like, in a sense that it doesn't argue that these kids are bad because they're looking for porn. It's saying, no, this is just something kids do and have always done, and that doesn't mean that they're bad people or broken people. Particularly when you look at, say, episodes in the first season, Millennium, where you occasionally maybe stray into subtext that might be tangentially related to stuff like that, like, say, Loin Like a Hunting Flame. I kind of thought this was very refreshing and very sort of something I really appreciated coming back to the episode.
Well, I mean, there could be various reasons for this. I mean, the one reason could be that because Avatar's crimes are so horrific in comparison, that, you know, three lads surfing for some boobs doesn't really seem particularly, you know, morally repugnant in comparison, for one thing. And I'm guessing that Michael Perry's a fairly liberal, you know, writer, in the sense that he doesn't necessarily, yeah, like you say, he's not judging them for that. You know, boys would be trying to look under their, you know, in their dad's basement or under their dad's like bed or something for the mucky mags that he was hiding from his wife, you know, back in the day, you know, all kinds of things like that. You know, it is that they weren't, and like you say, they have the moral character to actually realize that what they're watching is horrific and it's not you know, sexy or anything like that.
Or and not to run away from it. Yeah. Not to run away from it even, to own up. Like, they immediately start documenting evidence, and it's very clear from, like, the next sequence with Peter and Frank that they went to the authorities as well. And again, like, I quite like that. It doesn't portray it as something kind of shameful or something kind of like, you know, there's no correlation between what they're doing and what Zodiac's doing, which is very obvious to anybody. Yeah. It should be self-evident.
Yeah.
But there are times, particularly in the horror genre, where you will get films and TV shows and stories that will draw some sort of correlation between the two. And I kind of like that the Mikado resists that, particularly at a time in the late 90s when people were, you know, at that stage beginning to get terrified of what was on the internet waiting for their children, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And then you've got...
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So just a year later, you've got something like American Pie, which when you look back at, you know, is it Jason Biggs sort of live streaming Shannon Elizabeth basically stripping off in his bedroom, you know, and everyone just going, oh, yeah, whoa, you know, rubbing their hands with glee. And you look back at it now and you think, yeah, that's not cool, you know.
A little bit, yeah. Well, more than a little bit, yeah.
You know, so there's stuff like that. But I think also it could be that it's partly that Perry's got an interesting take on how, you know, the webcam is used based on one of the inspirations, in that a lot of this was based on something called Jennycam, which was one of the first sort of live constant stream cams by a woman called Jennifer Ringley. And she would just basically stream her entire life on the internet. And off the back of learning about that and being fascinated by what she was called a life caster, you know, and she was just broadcasting, that he started to think about what would the flip side of this be? You know, if you've got this person who's broadcasting and being quite an innovator and it's all, you know, and now that's the norm, you know, and that would have led to all kinds of different things and imitators. What happens if, you know, a serial killer or some terrifying force decides to abuse what is a very free and open system? So I think, you know, when you look at the comparison of, yeah, a bunch of lads surfing for stuff like that, you know, the moral... Okay, and so that when you put that next to the abuse of this form, which, and that's the thing with the internet, it's, and that's one of the things that they later say in when Frank is like, when they don't quite know who the girl is and they have to kind of figure out who she is and where she's from, and Frank's saying, well, you know, who's responsible, whose jurisdiction is this? And Peter says, well, there isn't any, because there is no jurisdiction for the internet. It's a lawless, but it's not just lawless, it's free. It's a free open source place. And that's something that people are still grappling with even today. This idea of, is the internet truly a free place? Should it be policed? Should there be laws in place for it?
Can it be policed?
Can it even be policed?
Is
it, yeah, is it too big? Is it too much of a Pandora's box that's been opened in that sense? So I think there's a lot he's exploring. And obviously, I know we're going to talk about that as part of the story. But I think the fact that he doesn't judge throughout this episode could be based on some of those touchstones as well, maybe.
Two things just before we move off the Jennifer Ringley thing, because this is amazing. The first is that she inspired an episode of Diagnosis Murder, which was called Rear Windows 98,
no,
which I absolutely love. That's the best title
is
ever.
That true?
Come on.
Is that true, Darren?
Yeah. I love that you're questioning.
I just,
Rear Windows 98, come on.
I just like the idea that you may have made that up as a joke for this podcast. That's amazing, though.
The second one is kind of even better, which is that, like, she was so famous that she managed to appear on The Late Show with David Letterman. And this gives you a sense of how out of touch people are with kind of technology and how, like, old media struggle to adapt to new media. Letterman infamously gave out the incorrect website address and directed thousands of users to an unrelated porn site.
Amazing. Oh, how wonderful is that? Well, yeah, and there you go. I mean, although, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure that that wouldn't happen today. You know, you know, something tells me that kind of mistake could still take place. But it is a fascinating, and you know, I think really, unless you really know a little bit about the history of the internet, she maybe has kind of faded from the popular consciousness. I don't know if everyone would know who Jennifer Ringley is and Jenny Cam, even though it's, you know, it was quite an important sort of formative thing in the 90s, you know. And that's, it's interesting, but it's, you know, it works as that sort of inspiration for this. Like I say, like a really, really good teaser. And then beyond that, it's all about starting to investigate this crime and trying to figure out who's responsible and where, you know, how do they find the girl who turns out her name is Rebecca Dampson. And that leads them to Frank and Peter to tap the services of Brian Rodecker, who this is played very memorably by Alan Zink. And this is actually Rodecker's final appearance. I keep forgetting this. Every time I watch the card, I always expect him to crop up again. But he went off and wanted to go and do theatre in Toronto, Alan Zink, instead. So he turned down future appearances of Rodecker, which, you know, is maybe was maybe not the greatest idea, but then I can't imagine he would have been in season 3 anyway.
He would have been very quickly pushed aside with everything else.
He probably made the right decision, actually, the actor. But this feels like the perfect kind of episode to actually have Rodecker go out, doesn't it?
Well, no, it does, because it's the ultimate Rodecker story. Now, to be fair, I think he is mentioned later on in a couple episodes. You get a couple of lines about the group having shut him out or locked him out or whatever. But yeah, it feels like if you're going to do a Rodecker story, if you got to do just one Rodecker story, this is the one to do. This is the episode where he's most handy and most useful. And again, I think he actually is used very, very well here, because he serves as kind of a foil to Peter, Frank, and, well, just about every other heroic character in terms of, like, understanding this stuff and being, you know, being friendly and being likable as a character, being somebody the audience is immediately on side with. Kind of, you know, again, very similar to the lone gunman in The X-Files to a certain extent, which is interesting, again, because of another Morgan and Wong creation in addition to an established mythos. But you have this way of kind of, like, bringing him in, and through him, like, the episode doesn't seem as afraid of technology as it could be. Because I think if you didn't have the Rodecker character there, particularly with the way that Frank talks about technology being distancing and putting a wall between him and his work, or the way that the police, you know, officers talk about how, well, if you got out and did it on foot like a real police officer, the episode could seem quite reactionary and quite sort of afraid of change and kind of sitting there quaking. I think having Rodecker there is basically a really clever and really nice way of going, no, actually, the internet is, as you pointed out, just a tool. It's a value neutral thing. It's basically, it can be used for wondrous things. It can be used for an amazing purpose. It can be used to serve good, but it can also be applied like any other tool for evil. You know, it can be exploited and it can be misused and abused. And I kind of like that Rodecker exists to provide a contrast in that sense. So it's not just a bunch of old fogies versus a tech literate villain. It's a, you know, a tech literate hero and a bunch of old fogies versus a tech literate villain, and I like that a lot.
Absolutely. You know, he does play such an important role in this story, and there's some interesting complicated psychology with Rodecker I think we'll get to later on as well. But I think what I really like about this is, and you get it right from when Frank and Peter sort of come into the story, they are completely out of their depth in this story. You know, pretty much until Frank decides that he's going to shake off the cameras and he goes off basically to find Avatar, they are really in the position of being from a different age. But then equally, not in the sense that you look back at this now and you see that they just don't, you know, you've got Peter saying, well, you know, the law hasn't kept up with the technology. And that's the kind of the point with those two, I think, in that it's not necessarily that they are actually dinosaurs with this stuff. It's just that this stuff is accelerating at such a fast rate. By this point, and this is only the beginning, obviously, you know, over the next 20 years, we will see vast, vast moves to the point we're in 2020 now as we record, and it couldn't be more different. But it almost feels like they are struggling to keep up with something that is beyond them, that they don't understand, that Rodecker does provide, and this is why you say he's important, because he provides that window into a world that he is able to keep up with, but is fringe right now. It's at that point where there are things he will talk about. I mean, a great moment, which is played for comedy, but I think is quite telling, is when he talks about how he goes online and he pretends to be a different gender. You know, and Peter says, that's too much information for me, Brian. And it's played to make, partly to make Rodecker look a little bit like a pervert, but also, in a way, it's quite prophetic and foretelling, because what Rodecker is basically saying is that on the internet, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what sex you are. It doesn't matter what gender you are. You can be who you want to be. But and someone like Peter, and maybe less judgmentally Frank, cannot get their head around that kind of cyberspace world that there are no structures and controls over.
Yeah, and I mean, that even happens with the victim, who was a librarian. And, like, Peter seems really weirded out that a librarian would be into, like, kinky erotica or bondage, like, groups or whatever. And kind of the episode is very clear with Frank saying, no, she's this, you know, she's not a victim because she used a computer. It's not her fault. We're not blaming her. It's not a high-risk activity or anything like that. It's not something that we're shaming her for. And again, I do think, yeah, that Rodecker thing, which is interesting because it is a comedy beat, but it's kind of, it's a very much an affectionate comedy beat in the sense of, again, where, like, if you didn't have that beat with Rodecker, the only real moment like that you would have in the episode is Lady Love, the author. And that's played in a much more cringy and embarrassing sort of way, where it's like, well, you know, this guy's kind of creepy because he's kind of talking about, oh, it's a nom de plume. It's many great writers use it and stuff like that, where he's meant to be ridiculous and kind of silly and kind of like, you're meant to be laughing at him and the absurdity of him. I think with Rodecker, like, yes, it is a little bit of cringe comedy, but it's very much like, while that's happening, there's a sense of, yeah, but we like Rodecker, and Rodecker's kind of, you know, cool is maybe a strange word. He's cool in the way Matt Smith's Doctor Who is cool, in that, like, he's likable and goofy, yeah. And he kind of, you know, he's never going to hang out with the cool kids, but he's kind of comfortable in his skin.
Nerd chic.
And I really like that. that's nerd chic, exactly. And the episode, I think, is entirely sympathetic to that. And it's notable that, yeah, throughout, one of the constant recurring motifs is that law enforcement simply can't keep up with technology. That sequence where they're trying to set up a conference call, and Rodecker's like, no, turn the focus ring. The focus ring. Not the Zoom. The focus ring. Or even little bits with, and again, something that has aged interestingly. The episode doesn't really go into it, but it's certainly, like, aged interestingly watching it now. The idea of the remote body cams during the raids, where their police are watching cameras that are recording everything they're doing. But the moment where one of the officers, who's being recorded, they're like, well, this is very urgent. We need to get in here. It's like, can you turn that camera away? And there's a smashing sound. It's like, oh, look,
yeah.
He left the door unlocked. which is, again, and there's this sense of, like, the cop not being able to keep up with technology, which is very much true. I mean, if you look today, look at things like how law enforcement's failing to keep up with things like, say, cyberbullying, to pick a very minute example, a tiny example of countless of those, but even say stuff like, say, revenge porn, various other sort of online crimes as well that law enforcement are kind of struggling to properly deal with. And I think that's very astute on the part of the episode to make that argument. And again, I think the beauty of Rodecker as a character is that if you didn't have Rodecker there, you would assume that the narrative sympathy defaults to, and it, to be fair, the narrative sympathy does default to the law enforcement characters who are struggling to keep up with the times. But if Rodecker wasn't there, you'd assume that it goes even further and would be more kind of Luddite.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Can be like, well, this changing technology is awful. Why do we have it? We shouldn't have it. It would be basically that version of the poor man's Tom Selleck saying, yeah, we should just, like, go outside more and talk to people and do real stuff, as opposed to treating him as a bit of a jerk. You know, which I kind of, again, is one of those things where it's very finely balanced.
Yeah. Exactly. And in that, if it was doing that, it would be painting, like you say, it would be painting the internet as a villain. It would be painting the whole thing as an evil, you know, force for nature, a force of nature, essentially, this technological force of nature. And Perry's a little bit cleverer than that, because he seems to understand that this isn't that it's not that the internet is evil and the internet is bad. It's that it's the corruption of it by someone like Avatar is what can turn it into something that is terrifying and that is unknown and that is scary and that is open to abuse. And I think that's where you do get this balance between that lighthearted comedy of people not being able to understand this technology, contrasted with Avatar absolutely understanding the power of this technology and manipulating it for the most horrendous ways, in the most horrendous ways, you know, and reaching out beyond it. You know, the whole sequence where they're talking about the girl, Rebecca, and Frank says, you know, he stalked her in the real world, then he stalked her online, and then he kidnapped her. So Frank understands pretty early on, really, that these two worlds can sort of intersect, even though Frank finds it difficult. These two worlds definitely can intersect, and it's hard for him to figure it out. Like that whole scene with the three different cities and the teams doing the raids and stuff.
Simultaneous interrogation.
And yeah. Frank is there, and he's like, "I can't do this on video," you know. And you have those scenes of people not really understanding how to interact with the camera. And do you know what it reminded me of? Actually, it reminded me of X-Cops in the X-Files, which is more of an overtly sort of comic episode, because it's playing on the idea of Scully hating being filmed and Mulder almost lapping up the fact there's a documentary crew there. But it's a similar idea in that they don't know how to interact with this technology that is trying to record what they're doing in these exceptional circumstances. The only difference with this is that it's more of a serious episode in many ways, and it's a lot of that interfacing with technology is about Frank being unable to do what he does with his gift, in inverted commas, over this medium. And that in itself, I think, is fascinating as well.
Two quick things before we move on. One thing just on the internet and kind of what we were talking about there and the idea of the internet being a medium. And again, like Frank literally describes it as a medium through which as the Avatar is working. Sorry, I called him Zodiac. I'm sure we're going to get to that in a second as well. But like one of the things is that like people kind of miss is that like this idea of all the bad stuff that existed on the internet didn't just like magically come into being on the internet. Before the internet existed, it existed on citizens' radio. I mean, there's a New Yorker piece from, I think, 1978, where you have like Kenneth Tynan talking about, you know, how you'd listen to people talking about how to construct firearms online, or people ranting in racist sort of nonsense, or masturbation fantasies that were the aural equivalent of rape, and how this would basically just flood the airwaves on radio before the internet was a thing. So all the stuff, all the bad stuff that we associate with the internet was kind of always there. And Perry's talked about how when he was writing this episode, when he was writing the Mikado, one of the things that interested him was that watching the user groups, and it's worth noting that like both the X-Files and Millennium had both fans who were very active online and writers who were very active online. I think was it one of the writers, I don't know whether it's Kay Rendell or Aaron Mayer, met Glenn Morgan online before meeting him in person.
Yeah, I think it was them.
One of the two, I can't remember which one of the two it was, but one of the two did before meeting him in person. I think they were yelling at him on the internet about the field where I
died. Yeah, they were, I think. Yeah.
And then we're meeting him, and then meeting him at a Writers Guild dinner later that evening, which is one of those great sort of the world is much smaller than you think it is stories. But like these shows are always very active on there. And Perry's talked about how, and this gets back to that idea of the screen as a dividing line. For him, one of the concerns when he was writing the Mikado was the idea of the screen as a kind of distancing effect. And something that's very true today as well. The online disinhibition effect, or if you want to be honest, the greater internet fuckwad theory. But the idea that like the screen creates a barrier that empathy can't pass. So like you will write things at people online. You will tweet them. You'll write them on social messenger. Back when this episode was written, you would write them on message boards directed at the writers of TV shows you don't like. And you would say things to them that you would never say in person. And it becomes dehumanizing. It becomes violent. It becomes aggressive. And this is one of the things that I think is really very far ahead of the curve in terms of the Mikado. Because you can see that element there, particularly with the emphasis on the idea of the audience and the people online who are clicking to the website expecting to see violence and expecting to see death and expecting to see a young woman suffer and feeling no empathy or compassion towards this victim, because to them it's just a spectator sport that's happening. And again, any number of modern parallels you can draw. The online dog piles that form. John Ronson's wonderful book, So You've Been Shamed, which is very, very worth seeking out and very worth reading. Or maybe it's You've Been Shamed on the Internet. I can't remember the name of it. Give it a Google. It's John Ronson. It's very, very worth seeking out. But like, you have this idea. And one of the things I find really prescient about the Mikado is that in 1998, it was doing something that was very dealing with those weighty themes, understanding that that was one of the dangers of the internet, because he'd already begun to see it happen. And again, you know, I mean, not to mention another X-Files podcast on here as well, but the X-Files files with Kumail Nanjiani, he used to go through the alt message boards for each episode as they aired, which are now available on Google Groups. And like, one of the things that was interesting about watching that as it went through the first four seasons of the show was that you could see the tone changing immediately and like very viscerally. You could see that in those early years of the internet, people were already settling into things like name calling and slandering and kind of, you know, sort of like being very aggressive towards one another in a way that I don't think you would in a face-to-face conversation. And I really like that the Mikado, which is an episode of, you know, Millennium from 1998, is like, maybe the internet is something that that allows us to dehumanize one another, which is very, very far ahead of the curve. I also really, really loved the dialogue in this episode, because you mentioned that sequence where Frank can't read through the screens. You know, I can't do this over the phone, he says. The moment later on where he's on the phone and he's like watching the body cam as they move through the cemetery, and he delivers, and again, it's a fantastic line. I apologize. I won't do any justice to it compared to Lance Henriksen. I can't put it into words.
Yeah.
But I do exist on the other side of words.
Brilliant.
And it's a beautiful line, but the kicker is Peter Watts' response to that, which is basically, it's gonna rain, Frank, which is one of those, like, give it over, you drama queen. We need to, like, we kind of need you to pull it together. I realize it's a big deal, but kind of, like, just work through it. And, like, even later on, you have that wonderful sequence where Frank is talking about, and again, it's one of those things where the line itself is brilliant, and the move, and kind of the episode is smart enough to know that it's also a little bit pretentious, so it becomes even better if it's both brilliant and then slightly needled. But later on, you have, like, Frank sitting down, kind of, like, contemplating the images, trying to make sense of them, and he describes the slipstream of electrons, which is like not a line I'm sure that many people can casually drop into conversation, but it works so well. Henriksen is great, and his delivery of those lines is great, and Perry's writing of Frank is fantastic. You'll notice he doesn't give those lines to Peter Watts or to Rodecker. He writes them specifically for Frank, and they work spectacularly for Frank because Henriksen can sell them. I really love those.
Yeah, 100%. You wonder if I mean, I'm assuming they are Perry, because James Wong gave this a once-over. You know, he did a rewrite, but apparently Perry has said this is 90% his work. So, you know, some of that could be James Wong, but the chances are that it probably is Perry. And I think ultimately, yeah, he nails the, you know, that poetic aspect of Frank. That this whole episode is very poetic for me. I think that, you know, you only have to hear the later on when Avatar leaves them a brilliant quote from Henry James, which is just a fantastic piece of writing anyway, but it's just really poetic. And I do love the script, and I think that it, like you say, it punctuates those moments that could be pretentious with those points of comedy. And I think it really does. I mean, you mentioned empathy. I think that's absolutely true. It's a fascinating idea, actually, the idea of the lack of empathy. And I think it's summed up by the fact that when Frank does finally get from behind the camera and he finds the girl at the end who's got pain, you know, inscribed in her head, and, you know, he takes the hood off and it's not Avatar, the empathy that pours out of him then for that girl, he just looks there and says, oh, and then he hugs her and he says, you're safe now. It's almost like that's all the empathy that he's been unable to almost channel through the screen because of the block that he would almost have, which has blocked his sort of his visualization and that slipstream, as you say. Not that he doesn't care when he's doing that, but it's more that he can't do it on video. He can't do that physicalization, that metaphysicalization, whatever goes on in his head, whatever that thing is, you know, there is a blockage with it. And I think it's fascinating how this episode deals with that, really, and manages to weave it into what is just a fantastic, you know, fantastic sort of mix of detective thriller and, you know, I don't even know how to describe it, really. Just internet detective story. Just a real mix of styles that almost defies a level of categorization, I think, really. And one of the better pairings with Peter. You know, I think this is one of those great examples. And like you said, you know, it's almost like a holdover from season one when those two had episodes where they worked together really well. But this does that blend. And maybe this is a good point for you to talk about, actually, when you mentioned how this fits thematically with the season, because I feel like this blends well the dynamic that him and Peter have as a pairing with also some of those added, you know, inflections of character with Peter and the Millennium Group in season two. And I'd be interested to hear what you think about how this as an episode sort of ties into some of that broader world building.
Just quickly, what you're talking about there, in terms of empathy, that's absolutely correct. And it's notable that when Frank does it, first of all, he doesn't just leave the screen. He crosses one side of the screen into the other. So you have Rodecker watching Frank on the screen, on the television set. And what Frank does, you'll notice the first thing that Frank does is he sits down in the chair where the victim's been. He literally puts himself in the same position as the victim.
He does.
And again, when you're watching that, you would expect the setup is that you expect the Zodiac to be appearing behind him and for Rodecker to be going, no, 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 you know, like that great.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Great sequence from Scream, for example, with the time delay on the video camera. And it doesn't do that. It's much smarter than that because it understands that it's not like this isn't a cheap thrill to get you surprised. This is an image that's actually important in explaining how Frank does what he does. He crosses the screen and he puts himself in the position of the victim. And the same thing even before he disarms your woman and sort of, you know, hugs her and embraces her. When he's coming up the stairs, he declines to shoot her. Like, the Zodiac's banking on the fact that he will see somebody in a Zodiac hood pointing a gun at him and pull the trigger immediately and instinctively. That's the ruse there. That's the trap. And Frank doesn't fall for it because he immediately senses it's another person. Even before he, you know, pulls the mask off and sees who it is, he's not going to shoot her unless he can. And again, that's arguably an extension of Morgan Wong's work and, say, The Thin White Line back in the first season. And that's kind of a nice point of intersection in terms of what you're talking about there. The first season, the second season of Millennium. Because Perry pitched this at the end of the first season. And he actually pitched it to Carter. I think he may also pitch it to Spotness. I think Ken Horton as well was there. And he kind of talked about how he felt like the episode was maybe a little bit orphaned kind of in the transition to power. Because he agreed to do it with Carter. He outlined the pitch. He knew what the episode was going to be. And by the time he arrived to actually work on it, there'd been kind of a regime change. Carter was busy running the fifth season of The X-Files and managing Fight the Future. And Morgan and Wong had stepped in and taken over the writer's room and were doing their own thing. And you can tell that it feels in a certain way like a first season holdover. You mentioned the Peter Watts and Frank Black chemistry. Also the fact that it's the rare second season episode that is a pure serial killer of the week story. It's the one that you could arguably slot into the second half of the first season and nobody really noticed that there's anything particularly wrong. You'd have to explain who Rodecker is, but otherwise it would fit pretty much perfectly. And it would even fit, you know, even the stuff like the Millennium Group having access to those computers would again fit with characterization of the Millennium Group in the second half of the first season. But one of the things that I think makes it work is that while it's structured very much like a first season episode, while it's written by somebody who is very much informed by their idea of what Millennium is from the first season, thematically, it's very, very close to what you see happening throughout the second season, where the second season is about this idea of kind of death and rebirth and cycles and the idea that, you know, the apocalypse is constantly happening and a result of the apocalypse is almost always kind of a spiritual rebirth of some description. The idea that, you know, the world is destroyed and created anew over and over and over again. And, you know, when one thing ends, another one begins. You know, the second season premiere being the end and the beginning. And so you have that happening here as well, where, you know, you have the Avatar killer, who is very transparently named, you know, the Zodiac killer. He is, I think that Perry joked that he wanted to call him the Omega killer, but then discovered that Omega Watches had provided Lance Henriksen with a watch and sponsored the after party. So that was apparently a no-go.
Brilliant.
That was like, You can't call him the Omega Killer. Which, again, would have tied into that idea of the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And the idea of the Zodiac being a kind of a calendar, that's like a set of star signs as well, that are constantly changing, coming back. But even then, the idea of the Avatar, you know, the Zodiac Killer being linked with the late 60s and the age of Aquarius, and the idea of a point where kind of the 60s died and kind of became and curdled into like the 70s, the cynicism that came from that. And the idea that, you know, if you wanted to read it that way, the Avatar as a manifestation or embodiment of the Zodiac Killer is arriving here in 1998, 1999, at a different point of social change, at a point of kind of where society is constantly kind of on the verge of kind of collapse or becoming something new or changing shape. And kind of like, I really like that idea. It isn't as direct or on the nose as, say, The Pest House, which is coming up, for example. It isn't as kind of like explicit in its themes as, say, Owls and Roosters. But I think it's very much there, this idea of kind of death and rebirth, and the idea almost of like, I really like that the Avatar Killer isn't caught, which kind of makes him immediately more interesting. He's the rare serial killer in the show who isn't caught, and we don't even get to see his actual proper face. In fact, we don't really get to see him at all. There's not even any close-ups of his eyes really gazing. You get any of those sort of like serial killer watching sequences. You know, you get to see him on the webcam, and you get to see his victims, and you get to see his costume, and you get to see sketches, but you don't really get to see much of him. So he remains completely anonymous, which is kind of interesting in terms of how he's characterized. But it also makes him seem almost supernatural, in a sense. It makes him seem almost like a ghost, like an embodiment of, you know, sort of like the idea of the concept of kind of like change, or the concept of anarchy or fear or terror or nightmares kind of lurking through the internet, or lurking through society as well. So the idea, like, you know, Peter jokes that, you know, there's no way that he could have been the Avatar Killer, because the Avatar Killer stopped killing 12 years ago. You know, he'd have to be very old now. How could he possibly be doing all this? How does the logistics work? You know, and then, of course, on top of that, you have the question of, like, why would he have stopped killing for 12 years or whatever? Or, you know, where did he go? And all this sort of stuff that, like, logically, you know, you have to wonder. There are all sorts of mechanical questions about how the Zodiac does what he does. Rodecker even describes what he does with computers as impossible. And Rodecker knows how computers work. And I kind of like the idea that there's the Avatar Killer is so vaguely defined that he almost becomes kind of supernatural, almost a ghost in the machine. He's almost kind of a concept rather than a person. He's not a real thing. He's kind of an idea. And I really, really like that about the episode. I kind of think that there's something very powerful in that. I think it's something that's very closely related to the second season rather than the first season. I imagine, again, I wonder if this was the first season, would Frank have caught the Avatar, and would you have had an interrogation scene at the end, for example? You know, or would you have had, like, glimpses of the Avatar Killer preparing to do what he's doing, you know, sort of preparing his knives or whatever, or fixing the video camera, you know, that sort of stuff? Would you have had more kind of leery sort of serial killer stuff in there? And I think that the Mikado, even though it is a conventional serial killer episode, is a lot weirder than most of the first season serial killer episodes, and I think that's a mark of the second season on it, I would argue.
Yeah, I agree. It's more interesting for me. You know, I mean, I find the second season of Millennium, as I've said before, far more interesting than the first, from a perspective of the way I enjoy storytelling being told. And I think in any other sort of way, in any other sort of presentation, the Mikado might have been one of my more disposable episodes this season, given the bank and the wealth of variety in this season and the amazing stories that they managed to craft in different genres and different styles. But this is one of the best serial killer stories I think I've ever seen put on television and maybe even film, you know, because it, like you say, it is steeped in that weird, uncanny tradition of a fascinating antagonist who he's never caught. He's in the same vein as for instance, maybe even Jack the Ripper, going back further back. That they're not people. They are representative of broader ideas, you know, and they'll never be caught and they will always exist. And Zodiac, I imagine, you know, I can't imagine the Zodiac killer who was never caught
ever being resolved.
Be found. Well, he's probably that person, he's that whoever did it, or however many people did it, or whatever, they're probably dead. If not, they are very, very old. So the chances of them ever being caught, certainly when they're alive, are very slim. And I imagine Zodiac will end up much like Jack the Ripper, and it will be a consistent, you know, urban myth and urban legend. And that's the great thing about Avatar.
Was it Jack the Ripper who described himself as midwife to the 20th century? Which is, yes, is actually, like, again, probably that. Something that feels very appropriate here. The Mikado could be, you know, seen as being midwife to the 21st century,
yeah,
you might argue.
Yeah, that's fascinating, definitely. And it is that great idea of that you could... In theory, in some, if they did finally do another season of Millennium with like an 80-year-old Lance Henriksen, you know, the first thing people would be saying is bring back Avatar. But then I'd be like, well, no, actually, because in a way, I wouldn't want the Mikado to be touched. I think this is a fantastic piece of work that deserves its place.
Oh, come on, you want the Kitsunagiri to its pusher? Come on, you want like the 20-year delayed Kitsunagiri?
Oh. Maybe part of me does, but part of me knows it would be a terrible idea, or it could be undone, but...
The Mikado's teenage son is on Twitter. Come on, it writes itself. Sorry, the Avatar's teenage killer's on...
yeah, mini Avatar. I think it's...
He is the Avatar killer because he kills people with egg-shaped Avatar... Come on.
We should just send this off now. Write the script, send it off to Chris Carter and be done with it. What I like about this as well is that it ultimately then basically provides a ticking clock from a narrative perspective, doesn't it? Because you have the murder room, have the number 696314, and then it becomes a race against time to make sure they find Avatar before another girl is killed when the web counters hit. I think it's a really fascinating idea as well when Peter and Frank briefly talk about how... Anyone clicking onto that site, knowing what's going to happen, are basically accessories to the crime. And I think that's a fascinating idea, that we can, that voyeurism, that internet voyeurism. And again, this ties into the empathy barrier of the screen, but the sense that there are potentially lots of accessories to these horrendous snuff killings, and they are as anonymous as Avatar. You know, they're just numbers on a screen, and I think that is a really terrifying thought, that you would have all these people, and they wouldn't all be like the the people they go in when they do those raids, and they go to that that quite fat guy, and he says, you know, I get off on their minds, you know, I'm not a weirdo. Well, it presents him as maybe somebody who's odd, but he doesn't seem odd. Again, he's more like, well, you know, I'm not out to hurt anybody, I just get off on their minds, I'm not interested in their physicality. And then, like you say, the sadly slightly creepy guy who, you know, almost certainly his marriage is over, unless he manages to convincingly lie to his wife. But, you know, it has those elements. But I know, I just like the way it sort of brings the audience, you know, anyone potentially, especially in this day and age, looking back at this, who might well go onto some objectionable material thinking that it's, you know, their hands are clean, you know, and how it sort of brings that viewer into that dynamic.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the really fascinating things about it, again, this is one of the things where, you know, Millennium's a show about evil, and there's a tendency, and again, I really like a lot of the second half of the first season. The second half of the first season is great, but there's a tendency, I think, in maybe the first and third season of Millennium to treat evil as something that deserves all caps and exclamation marks. Like, you know, Frank Black is quite literally seeing pictures of demons, you know, sort of like the second episode is called Gehenna. But yeah, like you have this idea of very rigidly defined good and evil. And one of the things that I like about the second season as a whole, and again, you know, we'll probably end up talking about it when I talk about the Pest House in a couple of weeks, but the idea that, you know, in the second season, what is good and what is evil become more blurred, and they become a lot less rigidly defined, a lot less cartoonish. And so you have this idea that if you are just somebody who clicks this link knowing what it is, even though it's a complete stranger, and even though you're not holding the knife yourself, you are responsible. You are culpable for what's happening there. And again, part of me wonders if you could extrapolate that a little further in terms of, like, as somebody who's consuming media or participating in kind of like just general schemes and stuff, you know, if you're buying a coffee that's not fair trade or whatever, is that the same sort of kind of sense of culpability? Because that's what, you know, this episode is about, the internet as a connection tool. It's something that brings us all closer together. You know, that shot of the the signal bouncing around the states. You know, everywhere is infinitely, is, you know, immediately connected to everywhere else. We are all connected to one another. And again, you know, a very pointed and very timely theme in this era that we're in right now, where we've realized how closely connected we are to one another, because it's very easy for something like the coronavirus to spread from person to person and bounce together off people and get all the way around the world, from China to, you know, to the US or to Ireland, just through the way that the world works. And again, you have this sense of like being interconnected, which is again something reminds you of something like The Good Place would do, where it kind of explores the idea that like when you're a person existing in that world, your moral obligations become larger and kind of more complex, in the sense of like you clicking in that picks up the counter, which moves her closer to death. So even though you haven't actually done anything by your estimation of it, you have participated in some way in this horrific system that's taking place, and you are in some way culpable for what happens. And I kind of, again, that's another example of Perry, even though the episode is grounded in the idea of the internet in 1998, understanding on a conceptual level how the internet works, understanding that, like, thematically, it's about connectivity, and it's about connectivity through screens. And it doesn't matter whether that screen is a gigantic monitor sitting on a desk, or, you know, a phone that you stare at and check in your pocket once every half hour. It's still the same concept, and it still applies just as much. And I kind of like that that discussion of culpability is as relevant now as it was when the episode first aired. It's probably more relevant now than it was when the episode first aired, because I think we're a lot more aware of how we're connected in these ways. And again, you know, to pick an example of stuff like fair trade coffee, for example, people are a lot more aware now of like the need to buy fair trade coffee or the value in buying fair trade coffee, even though the person that it affects is halfway around the world and you will never meet them face to face. And I think that episode, that aspect of the episode, has aged really, really well.
Yeah, I agree. It's ahead, again, like you said earlier, it's ahead of the curve in some of these ideas that it's exploring about what the internet means and how we interface with the internet and, yeah, how we engage with it. It's just fascinating. And it does a really good job of bringing you in to how this technology is used throughout the episode, with how, you know, eventually they have to try and stage a the murder room, essentially, in order to try and trick the IP to get more hits that will, you know, slow down, give them more time in order to find the avatar. To the point that, you know, they get a girl in, they put pay. There's the aspect of theatre you talked about with the avatar and the way they are performing is replicated in this, in the sense that they get this girl in and she has to pretend to be this, you know, would-be victim. And this is where I mentioned earlier, though, about Rodecker's interest in psychology, because there is a moment, isn't there, where he comes off as a creep to this girl, and it sort of plays with the idea as to, you know, she's saying, look, I'm not enjoying this, I'm not, you know, I don't want to be chatted up while I'm, you know, in this position. And there's a sense that maybe, you know, Rodecker's confused maybe about the situation, I think, in that maybe part of him is in some way attracted to her in this position and attracted to the situation, but not in a horrible way, more in a, because maybe he lives in this world a lot more, the line between that world and the real world is blurred for him. And I thought that was, because they didn't need to have that moment in there, but Perry intentionally writes that, and I think that's quite a telling aspect of, again, how we interface with this kind of technology.
Oh yeah, well that means, like, to give an example, that means that you have to hire an actor with an equity card to play the model. Because that's, I believe, her only necessary line in the episode. So, like, having that there is very much a very definite choice and something that was consciously, like, written into the episode and then kept in the episode through the edit. I think there is something to that. I think it's very much meant to kind of illustrate that, again, this sense of, like, Frank, the paradox of Frank not being able to cross over into the screen until the very end, when he literally crosses over into the screen. Paralleled with this idea of Rodecker maybe spending too much time on the other side of the screen and therefore not being able to navigate the real world quite as easily, not being able to read social cues quite as easily.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, anybody with half a brain would know, you know, he's being a little creepy,
yeah,
but he's being nice. Like, yeah, yeah. He's like, I could get you a glass of water. Yeah. The massage is a bit much.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, he's not being a pest. You know, being frank, one imagines the Frohickey would probably be a lot creepier in that sequence. But there's very much a sense of him not getting or reading the seriousness of the situation or reading the room, as it were. And her, like, that's what she says. She has to actually, you know, as you point out, she has to actually say, I am not enjoying this, just in case you don't get that from the fact that I'm tied to a chair with the word pain written on my forehead in makeup. And again, this sense of kind of not being able to draw the line between the two. So you have this, you know, this contrast between Frank, who can't imagine or can't quite get into the computer, and Rodecker, who can't quite get out of it, which I really, really like.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting parallel that's drawn quite overtly, but without being too on the nose. I think it's just, I'm glad, it's the sort of thing that I worry that many scripts would cut for time or because they didn't think it was relevant, but it actually does help in terms of bringing home some of these ideas and some of these themes. So I'm glad it's there, really. But then once they realise that this plan isn't going to quite work, they end up having to get to San Francisco and track down the Avatar. Interestingly, San Francisco, I mean, that's telling itself, isn't it? Because that's where the Zodiac killings took place, San Francisco. So that's a very maybe on the nose sort of acknowledgement that they live in the same world or they are the same sort of killer. I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, again, it's worth noting that Millennium went to San Francisco in its second episode in Gehenna as well, because San Francisco is, again, you know, this hugely symbolic, important place as well, because not only is it, you know, the place where the Zodiac hunted as well, Charles Manson would have lived there as well during the late 60s. And it has this association in American culture as representing, you know, the end of the West. It was the point at which, you know, sort of like you reached the Pacific and stuff like that. And so it's the end of kind of the American dream. But also in the 60s, it was home to the Summer of Love as well, and that kind of all the tumult that kind of came out of that as well. And again, that's tied up to in ideas like Manson. Just look at, say, for example, you know, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood last year as well. But I mean, even like the whole miniature Manson mania that you had around about 2019, with everything from The Haunting of Sharon Tate, which is, yes, something that exists. Hilary Duff, and it's quite Duff, let me tell you that. But also even, you know, like going beyond that to stuff like, say, that Netflix TV show, I can't even remember the name of it, but the Profiler one was very good.
Mindhunter?
Mindhunter, yes, that's the one. Where they have literally the same Charles Manson as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. They cast the same actor.
Did they?
Which is great. Yep, same actor. He got cast twice.
I didn't realise it was... Yep. I've seen them both, but I didn't... Of course, yeah. Wow, okay.
In his own justification is that there are very few 5'2" actors. So you really only have so many choices when you're casting Charles Manson. Yeah. But yeah, like you have this kind of sense of Manson kind of haunting the psyche and stuff like that. So yeah, it kind of, again, it does tie into all that stuff. It brings all the kind of Zodiac stuff coming through. I mean, like even Frank's account of like the serial, you know, the killing of the taxi driver and the searching of the city and the idea that, you know, the taunting letter from the killer who claimed to have been close enough to the agents. Now, he wasn't close enough to see their badges, but I believe he was close enough to describe them and kind of taunting them and kind of saying that they could have caught him, but they didn't. And you have that sort of whole dynamic taking place there as well. And obviously the cipher as well, which is something that's very Zodiac. And even the little observation from Peter Watts that it was an amateur who cracked the kind of cipher code, which again is another detail taken from the Zodiac case as well. It's remarkably well researched. And it's fascinating kind of as a result of that. I think it's fascinating in terms of like illustrating where the Zodiac kind of lies. Because again, and this feels kind of appropriate for a show like Millennium, where it's like, The X-Files is a show about monsters of the week. You are inevitably going to have episodes of The X-Files where Mulder and Scully meet iconic monsters. So, you know, think about Shapes where they meet werewolves, or Three when they meet vampires, or Postmodern Prometheus where they meet Frankenstein's monster. You know, you have this idea of like, you're doing this thing, there are these iconic elements that exist, you have to get around to doing them. So it feels only natural that you would have an episode of Millennium, which is a show about serial killers, where Frank Black confronts the most iconic unsolved American serial killer. Like, it feels almost like an event episode in that sense. And again, it's something where... And again, part of me wonders if I'm giving the episode too much credit. And again, maybe I am. But I think there's something interesting in how the episode plays with that. Because everybody is absolutely fascinated by Zodiac, by the Zodiac case. I freely admit that I am absolutely fascinated by the Zodiac case. And again, you have this whole industrial complex that kind of like spun up around it. These books, these documentary series, the movies, feature films, even Dirty Harry, obviously very heavily inspired about it, with its own Scorpio killer, played by Andrew Robinson. But like at the core of that, you have this serial killer who killed a bunch of innocent people. He murdered people. And it's kind of, there is something vaguely morbid about our fascination with that. And I say our because it is, I share it as well. There's no judgment here, like being entirely frank. But I've always found it fascinating, that kind of thing that exists with, you know, finding serial killers kind of fascinating and finding them kind of interesting, and the kind of like culture of celebrity that you build up around them. And I think it was Chuck Klosterman has talked about like meeting serial killer fans and like people who have like these awful watercolors of like Elvis painted by John Wayne Gacy hanging up over their sitting room, and how weird that seems to him, but how he also then will go and read a magazine about like the Zodiac killer and who it must possibly be. And I think that one of the things that I'm not sure the Mikado's doing, but I think it might be, and I think it's to the episode's credit that it's playing with this idea, is that it almost perhaps kind of implicates us in this, in that, like, we're fascinated by serial killers. We're fascinated in seeing Frank Black take on the Zodiac killer. Yeah, fist pump and stuff like that. And there absolutely is a difference, but is there that much of a difference between us tuning into a TV show where we watch Frank Black hunt the Zodiac and somebody clicking onto a website where maybe a girl will die if they click there? I think there absolutely is, to be clear, but I think that it kind of, the episode also kind of hints at that blurring of boundaries and that idea that, you know, maybe that empathy gap doesn't always exist, you know, isn't exclusively to kind of, you know, to the internet. Maybe it exists in other media as well, in terms of like, if we're watching, you know, Dirty Harry, are we thinking about the innocent people that the Zodiac killer murdered, or are we thinking about how cool and fascinating this whole weird little corner of American mythology is? And I find that something interesting to kind of think about. And again, I say that as somebody who has had that fascination, who's, you know, convinced his grandmother to buy him books about American serial killers, and who finds the whole aspect of stuff and that aspect of psychology and individuals and kind of history fascinating. At the same time, it's a little bit wary of it, a little bit anxious about it, and kind of maybe sees it being a little bit exploitative. And I wonder if the Mikado, you know, on top of being an episode about the internet and about, you know, connection, is also in some way about this idea of watching serial killers through screens. And should we maybe be a little bit less comfortable with that than we are?
I certainly think it is. I mean, you know, I think that the whole conversation about, you know, us being, you know, voyeurs to these horrible acts and the sort of moral judgment that Peter places on people in that sense of, you know, being accessories to a crime, you know, and the whole idea that these boys, even though they do the right thing, they stumble upon a snuff, you know, film, and there would be boys out there who would just keep watching and wouldn't necessarily be the ones calling the police, you know, and that's so I think that's absolutely there, definitely. And, you know, you only have to look at now the weight of true crime fascination these days, you know, from true crime documentaries to podcasts to all kinds of things that are on streaming services, you know, internet websites. You know, there is a massive, I mean, to be honest, much as I really enjoy the Mikado, true crime really isn't my cup of tea at all. You know, I don't particularly enjoy that stuff. In fact, it creeps me out quite often reading about real life. Much as I really love this episode and I love Millennium, I actually don't like particularly reading about this stuff in real life, because it really does unsettle me and it's quite horrible. And I think, but there are massive amounts of people who do, you know, are fascinated by these people and the psychology behind it and the mystery behind it. Even the people who were caught, you know, even the Ted Bundys of this world, the mystery of why and how do you end up getting to that point? How do you become that person, that monster, whatever, you know, how do you become an avatar, basically, in this episode? And that's fascinating.
And it's worth noting as well that, like, you mentioned the true crime boom. And again, this is one of the things where the Mikado, again, And again, I worry that I'm giving it too much credit, but I think it's very much ahead of its time, yeah. despite being of its time, where like we are having those debates about true crime. We're having those debates about the Serial podcast. We're having those debates around things like Tiger King, for example. We're having those debates and discussions about whether this is exploitative, whether this is cynical, whether the people producing this content and the people consuming this content are being predatory, or whether they're being exploitative, or whether they're kind of harnessing the suffering of other human beings for clicks and for ad revenue, for streaming service gains and stuff like that. And again, it feels very much like The Mikado isn't directly about that, because obviously streaming and podcasting didn't exist when the episode was written. And obviously, you know, in the context of even true crime, you know, the true crime boom didn't really exist. Those sort of documentaries tended to air on television and were kind of seen as being cast-offs or whatever. But there is this sense of, you know, within the context of this episode itself, Michael Orr Perry, you know, and the production team are capitalizing on the Zodiac myth in order to give Frank an enemy worth fighting. And is that, you know, is that something that we're comfortable with, given that he murdered people? And I kind of love that the episode goes there. And again, I'm not being judgmental whatsoever. I'm not a huge fan of true crime sort of stuff, you know, in particular, not of Serial podcasts, just because I don't find it particularly interesting. I am a big fan of kind of like books and deep dive articles that get into this stuff. I find that stuff very interesting to read. And it's for exactly the reasons that you mentioned, which is like, how does a person end up like this? What is a person like? How do you recognize that? Are they the same as us? Are they fundamentally different? Is there a gap that exists between me and somebody who did that? Because I know there is, but I want to know for sure. I want to know exactly what that is, because I want to know that there's a difference between me and that person. I want to know fundamentally that there is. And again, there's this kind of, I find that, you know, I obviously find that stuff fascinating, but I also find the Mikado playing with that idea interesting. And again, it's worth noting that, you know, you could argue that Perry comes back to that theme for better or worse in 13 years later in the third season. So I think that maybe that aspect is here. And I think it's very, again, very, very timely, very ahead of its time, and kind of like managing to be those two things at once, which I absolutely love about the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And it ends, of course, with Frank finally tracking down the Avatar's potential final victim. And this is where we get the title makes sense, because the abandoned sort of theatre is blasting out the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta The Mikado, which is where the title comes from, and the song from Act 1,
The Lord High
Part
Executioner.
5 of The Mikado. Yeah, Behold the Lord High Executioner, which is obviously, you know, this is an old callback, because this operetta came out in 1885. You know, this is very 19th century British, you know, theatre. Why do you think that Perry chose to use The Mikado? Obviously, the song Behold the Lord High Executioner has a literal sort of, you know, sense in terms of the Avatar. But what do you think his thought process was behind making this so key to that sort of finale?
I think it gives a sense of timelessness to it as well. Like, I mean, that's the thing with the, again, and this is the thing where it's always been happening and it will always be happening, and it's just the medium that changes. Because, you know, when they talk about the video that's streaming, like even before they know that it's the theater and even before they see the curtain, Peter and Frank are talking about it as, you know, sick performance art. And Frank makes it clear, yes, he is performing and we are the audience. And like, so the theater like becomes an older expression of that. It's you know, the video camera, you know, the web camera is a video camera, but the video camera is really just it's equivalent to sitting, you know, in a couple of rows back from the stage staring at, you know, an actor performing a play. And like, that's the climax, gives you that, where it's like, it becomes a theater. He steps into a theater, but he's also inside Rodecker's computer, because the two spaces are the same. They're just separated by hundreds of years, but the basic concept is the same, which is the concept of spectacle. And again, the Lord High Executioner is one of those things, because it's a song that was written before you have CDs where he's playing the music, where, you know, where Frank and Peter are listening to the music in the base or in the sort of Millennium Group headquarters. But even like when it's, you know, when it's broadcast as part of a file, as a wave file, with that single digit displacement, it's gone digital as well. But it doesn't matter, because that song itself has existed in one form or another going back to, you know, the 19th century. It's existed, you know, over 100 years. You know, was it, when was it written?
1885.
It was 1820? 1885, so yeah, well over 100 years at this point. And it's just changed form. The media, like the Zodiac Killer, or like the Avatar Killer, the medium through which it's moving has changed, but the song itself has remained fundamentally the same. And I don't know if, you know, outside the fact that Lord High Executioner is very obviously thematically relevant, outside of wanting to use a piece of classical music or a piece of recognizable music, you know, that, I suspect, might have been a reason to choose it, is because you want an old song that has been, over the course of the episode, you know, played in a WAV file and played over CD, performed in a theatre and streamed on the web, and therefore showing that, you know, no matter what it moves through, no matter how it changes in terms of, you know, the medium through which it's moving, the message remains the same. The message remains constant. And I really like that.
And it could be something in the fact that when Frank is chasing the Avatar, there the chorus that comes on is the following. So it's the line, it's this: it's taken from the county jail by a set of curious chances, liberated then on bail, on my own recognizances, wafted by a favouring gale, as one sometimes is in trances, to a height that few can scale, save by long and weary dances, surely never had a male under such like circumstances, so adventurous a tale which may rank with most romances. And then the chorus is defer to the Lord High Executioner. To me, I feel like that's an intentional chunk to take from this, actually. There's just something about those words that in some sense could almost be the Avatar story, in another sense could also suggest a level of power, I think. And even though you can read into it different ways, it's not necessarily perfectly connected. I always feel like there are intentional choices made with where things are placed in a show like Millennium, particularly the second season of Millennium. So it's interesting to think of those words and hear them as, you know, they're having that showdown, and wonder if there is an added level of subtext.
There's also the grand tradition of serial killers listening to classical music. I mean, obviously going back to Silence of the Lambs is probably the big example here, where Hannibal Lecter has his kind of murder spree to this wonderful kind of classical music. And it feels like Gilbert and Sullivan is kind of, and again, this is one of those things where it's obviously Perry's idea, but it fits very much with that thing that Morgan and Wong do a lot, where you have that ironic juxtaposition, where Gilbert and Sullivan, if you haven't watched it or had the pleasure, is generally the campiest thing you can imagine. It's delightful. It's amazingly joyous and wonderful. Again, you have to be in the mood for it. It will drive you up the wall if you aren't. But to have that juxtaposed with this sequence of brutality and murder and violence is one of those things very similar to that moment in Home with Wonderful, you know, where you have this song that should be, you know, joyous and upbeat and happy, and it's contrasted with what's actually happening on screen to create this powerful dissonance, which I think is really, really, really effective.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Finally then, before we go, I've got one question for you then, Darren. Let's see what you think of this. If Avatar came back today, what would he do? Where would he go? What kind of vehicle would he use? What kind of medium would he use, off the top of your head just now, to continue his reign of terror?
You and I are not nearly cool enough to do this. This is going to be embarrassing. We're going to show our age. I'm going to be like, oh, Zodiac will be on Quibi. That's where Zodiac will be. I don't know. TikTok?
I just thought of TikTok.
30-second videos?
Yeah, I just immediately, that's what popped into my head, TikTok.
Yeah, that's like the fact that the two of us thought of TikTok means that TikTok is immediately uncool, and therefore not where he would hang out.
I said this to my students. I work with teenagers, like sixth formers, and I said to them, they said, "Sir, do you know what TikTok is?" I said, "Yeah, I know what TikTok is." And I said, "That means you need to stop using it." And they were like, "Why?" I said, "Because I know what it is. This is no longer cool, guys." And they didn't seem to understand that, but they will. Oh, they will one day.
TikTok is kind of was my first instinct. Although I kind of do love the idea of him. Have you read the Quibi, the announcements, the shows that are showing up on Quibi? You know, there's concepts like there's what's it called? It's Deconstructed, I think, is what it's called. But it's basically Titus Burgess fires a meal out of a cannon at a blindfolded food critic, and they have half an hour in which to reconstruct it from memory of taste, which sounds like something that doesn't exist. Like, there's no reason why this should be a thing, but it is. There's also, like, Murder House Flipper, which is about, like, people who buy murder houses and try to, like, flip them on the property market. So, like, part of me wonders if, like, Zodiac's ultimate revenge might be to show up at Quibi head offices and get himself commissioned.
Maybe. It may... there are worse ideas for the Avatar sequel episode, I'm telling you. That's...
Zodiac goes commercial. Yeah. By the way, listeners, I am not, like, that sounds like I'm making it up. I am not making it up. That is like actually what Quibi offers.
Darren, we all know that we are way now through the looking glass in this world. You know, the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years, nothing is surprising anymore. So,
it's called Dishmantled, by the way. That's.
Of course it is.
Not deconstructed, apologies.
Of course it is.
There's also Chrissy's Court, which is real people, real cases, and real legally binding decisions. If you thought Chrissy Teigen couldn't become an actual courtroom judge, you've been overruled. You Ain't Got These, which is produced by Lena Waithe, which is not a show about sneakers. It's a show about sneaker culture, fitting in, and belonging to something bigger than yourself.
Do you think that when... they made the Mikado, they thought that this would be where we'd end up in 22 years. Because I'm not sure. I mean, in a way, maybe Avatar should just come back and end it for all of us. You know, given what you've just told us. Maybe you'd be doing us a blessed relief.
Yeah, but yeah, no, so I can, like, if Avatar were coming back today, he would have a show on Quibi, yep. And it would be a breakout success.
I love it.
Oh, there's also the famous Killing Zac Efron show, which almost killed Zac Efron. That was a Quibi production as well. Do you not hear about this? This is the one where he went to the exotic desert island to film a reality TV show about surviving on an exotic desert island and then almost got killed immediately.
Wow.
They would have had a hell of a first season cliffhanger.
Yeah, that's method to the max, that is. I tell you. Well, there you go. I think that's perfect then. Avatar would get a show on Quibi and make the most insane television and then just start killing people. You know, sending people to desert islands and leaving them to die.
By the way, Chrissy's mum... turned bailiff, Pepper Tye, maintains order in her courtroom.
I feel like we've just become an advert for Quibi now, so we should probably...
that's fair.
We should probably leave it. But on that note, Darren, it's been fantastic to talk about The Mikado with you. An episode of television and Millennium I have just adored for over 20 years, and I will adore for the rest of my life, I think. So I don't think I could have talked about this in the depth and with the interest that we have with anybody else. So thank you. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight as well. And again, really, really loving the excuse to go back and watch the second season of Millennium. It's one of the great seasons of television, and this is just a fantastic episode.
Yeah, 100%. Completely agree. So yeah, we'll be back. Well, I won't be back next week. We're gonna reteam a little bit later in the season, actually, for another season two gem, A Room with No View, the fantastic Lucy Butler episode. So that's going to be a very different one to talk about. Love is Blue, Darren.
I feel like there's no way that A Room with No View, which is about a bunch of people trapped in a house with a bunch of strangers, unable to go outside and feeling petrified and sort of slowly smothered by that fact, could have aged in any way similar to the way that the episode we just watched have. There's no way that episode speaks to the current moment at all.
Absolutely not, no. What could possibly be like that in this day and age? I can't even begin to think. But Yeah, we'll be back for that one, which will be fascinating to talk about. But until we do come back and talk about that, Darren, why don't you point people towards what you're up to on the internet with your podcast and your writing and things like that, and where they can find you.
Perfect. So you can find me online at The Movie Blog. You can also follow me on Twitter, Darren_Mooney. I co-host another podcast called The 250, where we take a look at the 250 greatest movies of all time as voted for by IMDb users. The week that this is kind of coming out for patrons, I believe we'll be talking about the wonderful Snatch, Guy Ritchie's Snatch.
Oh, yes! I love that film.
With the wonderful... which is great. We're talking about it. We're kind of doing an hour world tour. So the idea is that while you're self-isolating or while you're kind of locked in, we're kind of taking world cinema and bringing it to you. And I know Snatch may not count as some people's idea of world cinema. I know you live in the country where Snatch was written, filmed, and, you know, sort of takes place. But like it is kind of like an international film for American audiences. And we'll be joined by the wonderful guys from When Irish Eyes Are Watching as well to talk about its portrayal of the Irish traveler community. And it's the credibility of its accent. And then the week after, you will be joining us, actually. We're very thrilled about this.
Yeah.
You'll be joining us to talk about The Wages of Fear.
Yes.
Which I'm really, really, really excited to talk about. So yeah, that's coming up. And then afterwards, I think you may be having us as a guest on one of your podcasts as well, talking about maybe Sorcerer, I think.
Yeah.
And then basically we'll be kind of bouncing off and doing some other kind of world cinema stuff. We'll help you covering some anime. We'll be taking a look at The Seventh Seal, which is another movie that has probably aged incredibly and uncomfortably well. and maybe Xavier Dolan's Mummy as well over the coming weeks. So we're basically taking the best of the world cinema and bringing it to your ears. And we hope that you enjoy.
Marvellous. You're also going to be rocking up on We Made This Is Star Trek podcast, Make It So, talking a bit of Star Trek Discovery as well. And you've been on talking about Star Trek Picard recently as well, which is great. So yeah, you're jetting off to the final frontier there too. And yeah, you can check out all these extra podcasts on the We Made This Podcast Network at We Made This Pod on Twitter and www.wemadethispod.com, and find all the different podcasts, including the X-Cast, the X-Files podcast, on there. So we'll give you a little bit of a taster of what's to come on there very soon after this episode ends. But yeah, we'll be back together fairly soon. Next time, Kurt will be back in the hosting seat, I think. And yeah, we need to just power down our internet now, turn off our TikToks, or turn on our TikToks, actually, because, you know, we're living in that age now. Turn off our... I've run out of internet things to say, Darren. Turn off our modems.
I'm sure you'll land the next one.
There we go. Right.
No worries. Sorry, I'm just not hardwired for this sort of thing. Yeah. Sorry, I need to dial it back.
Right.
Don't take that tone with me.
We need to stop. So, until next time, guys.
Servers, you right?
Remember, thanks for listening, and this is who we are.
Previously on the We Made This Network. Pick up a podcast.
One thing they don't teach you, or there's no, like, one thing you're not prepared for when you start podcasting is the overwhelming imposter syndrome you have. Sometimes you're like, dude, especially in this case, because there was no other Outer Limits podcast. And so, like, I'm like, dude, if I have to hit the ground running, like, if it sucks, I mean, if you're like the 10th Outer Limits podcast and you suck, you know, whatever. But if like you're the only one, so many people have in their mind like what they want to hear.
Without a Mouse.
How was your Disney trip anyway?
Yeah, it was great. I've really enjoyed it. I got my photo taken with an Elvis impersonator at the front gate.
Good.
Outside of Disney World.
And I can't believe you managed to kick Mickey, Goofy and Donald Duck in the balls.
Yeah, yeah.
All three.
Went for the hat trick.
Yeah, the holy trinity.
Apparently I'm the first person who's actually successfully done that in the whole of the world.
Yeah.
So they'll be writing books about me.
They will do.
I also was really glad that I only got food poisoning 3 times. What was out there this time.
A new record for Disney.
Yeah, and a new record for me as well.
Please don't sue us, Disney. I'm sure everything is fine. Or if you have got food poisoning, they'll make you leave the park first before declaring it's food poisoning.
Pick a disc.
If we look at Marilyn and then we look at Too Late to Die Young, we start to realize that Dan Byrne has kind of a cultural fascination with some of the figures of his parents' generation, because he's talking about Elvis and James Dean and Marilyn Monroe, and a couple of the other songs have references to like Muhammad Ali and Pete Rose. Pete Rose and Roberto Clemente are in this song, Marlon Brando. So he does have this fascination that I think some people criticize him for. I think he's been like, hey, if this is supposed to be like a Gen X Bob Dylan, then why is he fascinated with all the same figures that the baby boomers were fascinated with?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network.